It's back, alright. Today on Vox Talks, what's driving the supply and demand for cryptocurrencies? And of course, the price at which they trade. Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. At the beginning of 2021, just before Bitcoin's 12th birthday, it broke the 30,000 barrier for the first time, $30,000 for a Bitcoin. And that was just 3 weeks after it broke through $20,000. But it hasn't been a steady upward climb for Bitcoin. In 2017, the price shot up from $1,000 to $17,000, but then it plunged to a third of that value. So what or who is determining these price movements, and what does that mean for the longevity and usefulness of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies? Well, what we know about the emerging topic of crypto microeconomics has been summarized in a new CEPR discussion paper, and Neil Gandalla of Tel Aviv University and the CEPR is one of the authors. So welcome to Vox Talks, Neil.
Thanks, Tim, and I'm happy to be here.
Let's start off with some background on crypto for non-experts. Could you explain where a Bitcoin comes from and who's guaranteeing that my Bitcoin has any value at all today, let alone $30,000?
Okay, great. Let me just say one thing first, that this survey, the microeconomics of cryptocurrencies, is also joint with Hannah Halliburter, Guillaume Herringer, and Joshua Gans, and it is forthcoming in the Journal of Economic Literature.
Yes.
And our goal in this survey was to exactly do what you said in the introduction, Tim, is to try to put the microeconomics of cryptocurrencies into some framework. And it involves several rewrites, but in the end, we basically provide some background, look at the supply side, the miners, you asked where Bitcoins come from, we look at the demand side, finally the price you mentioned, and then we go into competition. And the important thing was not just to mention every paper in the literature, but rather to provide a framework to help researchers, micro-researchers move into the space. Mm. And before I say where the Bitcoins come from, just wanted to make a note that it actually passed $40,000 recently.
I wish I could say I actually had this hypothetical Bitcoin I was referring to. But right. Anyway, if I did, then who guarantees that it is actually worth that $40,000?
Right. And nobody guarantees it at all, because it is decentralized. And I'll talk a little bit more where they came from, but let's go into this for a second. Nobody guarantees at all. There's no central authority. And, you know, in the end, it's something digital. So is it really worth anything? Well, I guess it's worth what people are willing to pay for it. But as you pointed out, the prices really, really do go up and down. Maybe we'll get into this later, but you could also ask, why is gold worth so much? About 17% of gold is held for investment value. But to go back to where the Bitcoins come from, they come from a protocol. There's a mining process where, let's call them computer experts who have lots of computing power, will try to solve a complicated hashing problem. And the first computer expert or team that solves it actually is able to create the Bitcoins. How does it work? Once someone solves it, it's really, really easy to prove that that was the solution. It's not the same thing, but if you think of, you know, two large primes being multiplied together, if you just look at the output of that number, you know, it's hard to know what the primes are. But once someone tells you what the primes are, you can see that it multiplies to that number. It sort of works like that. There's a degree of difficulty which is set automatically so that Bitcoins are released in a steady manner. Indeed, there will only be 21 million in the world, and there's about 17 million out there now. So how does it come out? Someone solves this puzzle, and then there are some transactions waiting to take place, and whoever solves it has the right to select which transactions they want to process. And in addition to doing that and getting some transaction fees, that miner who solved that problem gets new Bitcoins. And that's how new Bitcoins are created. So every time that we complete a block, okay, we have the same game again where this puzzle needs to be solved. And like I said, the degree of difficulty is adjusted so that Bitcoins are coming out at a steady rate. I hope that's okay. I mean, I tried to be non-technical here. Does it make sense?
The more you get into this, and actually your paper does get into a lot more detail detail on it. We just don't have time for that today. But the more you get into it, the more mind-bending it is. And I've been following this from early on, and many people early on, and I will admit that I was one of them, assumed that without this central authority, then Bitcoin production would in some way be hacked, or one miner would become very dominant, or it would fragment into conflicts about what Bitcoins were and which were the real Bitcoins. But this supply side for Bitcoin seems to have been very stable. Am I right, Neil? Why is that?
You're right. And in part, it's due to the protocol. But in part, it is also due to the fact that Bitcoins are relatively highly valued, especially now. Mm. And that makes an attack costly. Indeed, in order to understand how Bitcoin works, you have to go back to the mining game and you have to see, would any of the miners have an incentive, perhaps even to hook up together and to try to, let's say, fork the blockchain? Because the suggested rule to follow is if there are two blockchains moving forward, this can happen, by the way, if, say, that two people got to a solution within a couple seconds of each other. Mm-hmm. So then there could be two blockchains moving forward, and the rule of thumb that Bitcoin follows is to follow the longest chain. Now, that's just if there's an inadvertent error, and that usually gets taken care of pretty quickly. But it's possible that someone tries to fork it. And the question is, how costly is it? And the nice thing about this survey is we use simple microeconomic analysis based on a model by Eric Budish at the University of Chicago, which shows that assuming that there's free entry into the mining process, which there is, and assuming that it's possible that there will be incentives to hack and steal the Bitcoins, which there are, when is that possible and when is that not possible? And so you work out the equations. And in the case of Bitcoin, it has been robust. Like I said, it's partly due to the protocol, but partly due to the high value of Bitcoin. I should point out that other coins have been successfully hacked. There are a lot of cryptocurrencies, and some of the lesser valued ones have been successfully hacked. Mm. You asked about the mining. Why can't the miners team up? The miners have, by and large, been careful not to have more than 50% of the mining power. In the Buddhist model, with 50% of the mining power, it shows what can be done. And just taking a look at it recently, it looks like of course, the mining industry is concentrated. No longer can you and I, Tim, go in our home computer and just mine some Bitcoins, although it would be great given the current price. But it's not that concentrated. And I think the leading mining pool now has about 17 to 18% of the total market in terms of how many of these puzzles are they solving. It used to be higher. So far, so good. But you're right. There's no guarantees at all.
Anyone who spent time around people who are big Bitcoin fans will know that they tend to see the world in a slightly different way. There tends to be a very strong libertarian streak amongst them. Are the people who mine and acquire Bitcoins today still the same as the type of people that were involved in the beginning of the Bitcoin story?
No, it really changed over time. And you're right, libertarians were, I think, behind this, you know, the idea that it would be great to have a system without a central authority. This way there, you know, if we control the supply also there in a systematic way, there wouldn't be inflation. Indeed, Bitcoin is probably very deflationary. And at the beginning, you're right that the interest was limited to miners and to libertarians. And that was, I would say, the early stage.
Yeah.
Afterwards, we went through a stage where there's a lot of illegal activity going on. The black market, gambling, it's still a lot. I mean, as we move into the current stage, I mean, it's not that we don't have these illegal activities. There's still a large amount. Indeed, one paper estimates that a quarter of Bitcoin users are involved in illegal activity, and this represents about 45% of Bitcoins. Mm. But yet, the legal the legal use of Bitcoin has been growing, but it's primarily been a speculative asset rather than being used in any way in transactions. So very few of the top 500 retailers accept Bitcoins. And until recently, very few of the other retailers accepted it. There are some problems accepting Bitcoin if the price is going to go up and down like it's been going up and down recently.
Yes.
So the primary activity has been speculation. Again, we don't really know who holds all these Bitcoins, but there's a sense that there's speculation. And a lot of mainstream financial firms are now trying to get into this industry. And there's been some attempt to get exchange-traded funds approved by the regulators. This process is moving slowly, but it is moving in that way.
So to sum up, the people who are holding Bitcoins at the minute, even though we've had a decade of people saying Bitcoins will soon be a digital currency just like any other, they are really using them as an investment at the moment. A very risky investment, but an investment nevertheless.
Yes, I would say most of the legal use of Bitcoins is in speculation. And you're right. We think that there are some users who acquired a lot of Bitcoins near the beginning and have, you know, large market share. It's quite concentrated. You know, a lot of them are still holding on to these Bitcoins. And so far, over time, it hasn't been a bad investment. But you're right. Anything can happen.
Yes, their hypothetical wealth must be enormous now for some of those early holders.
Yes, indeed.
Bitcoin, yes. And now we've had a load of other people coming in on that investment, and a lot of them have come in on the back of hype. You can't use social media for very long without seeing people pushing Bitcoin and why Bitcoin is a good strategy for investment in the future. And also you see a lot about it in the newspapers, especially when it does things like breakthrough $30,000 or $40,000 in value. How much of those price rises are driven by this hype, and how much is that just reflecting what's going on with the price?
Okay, that's a really good question. There's no doubt that there's a correlation. And then the question is it that social media searches, you know, intense interest is leading to a higher Bitcoin price, or is the fact that Bitcoin's price rising leading to more and more interest in social media? And I think there's one paper that suggested that up until the first half of 2012, Bitcoin's price would jump first before social media would take interest. And perhaps more recently, the reverse is true. But I don't think that we've really solved that out yet. But there's clear that there is a correlation, no doubt about it.
Is it possible that Bitcoin is that thing that all economists love, a price bubble?
Yes, it is. And we've seen a few, let's say, bursting of the bubbles. The first spectacular rise was in 2013 when Bitcoin rose from $400. Think about that, only $400 to more than 1,000. And that was primarily due to price manipulation. And actually, I have a paper with some co-authors where we had amazing data that we didn't know who the people were, but we had user IDs, data that actually went into the web after a huge exchange went down. And you could see that there were some accounts that were doing unusual buying on certain days. And by and large, they managed to, all of us are pretty convinced that they managed to increase the price. Once these actors stopped operating, the price fell back pretty quickly to about $200. But there have been other spectacular rises. For example, Bitcoin stayed relatively in a small trading range. It didn't break $1,000 again until the beginning of 2017. And then during that year, it rose to $19,000 and fell back. Bitcoin fell back in early 2018 to $3,000. We're not sure why. It's not clear. There hasn't been any defining, I would say, conclusions regarding what burst that bubble. But currently, as you noted, it was 30 and trading at $40,000. The question is, how high could it go? And is this a bubble? And you could do the following hypothetical. Suppose that you took all money in investment gold. So I'm not talking about gold that's used for jewelry or an industry. If you took all the gold that was used for investments and converted it into Bitcoins, you could make a calculation and it would show that Bitcoin could be worth $100,000. Okay. So when people mention these kind of exorbitant prices, and people have before mentioned $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, I think that they're making calculations like this one.
Now, so far, Neil, we've talked about Bitcoin as if cryptocurrency is Bitcoin and Bitcoin is cryptocurrency. But as you mentioned at the beginning, there are many other cryptocurrencies, and technologically, some of them are much more suited to the sort of applications that we would have in the real world if it was used more for transactions than investments. So why is Bitcoin so dominant at the moment?
We basically came to the conclusion that network effects gave Bitcoin a big early lead, which it held on to. But I want to say that it's not a total win for Bitcoin in the sense that It's true. In the early years, it accounted for, after the first bubble burst in 2014, Bitcoin was about 95% of the total valuation in the crypto market. It actually did fall below 40% during the significant rise in 2017. It's back up to now to 65 to 70%. And it's been, that part of it has been pretty steady in the last few years. But you are right. There's other cryptocurrencies like Ripple and Ethereum and several others that are quite suited for smart contracts or for building applications on top of blockchains. They're much more sophisticated than Bitcoin. So, like you said, the question remains, why does Bitcoin still have this huge lead? And I guess in part of it's due to the fact that in the illegal activities, it's still the choice of those who are, you know, locking computers and demanding payments and ransomware, and probably for purchasing illegal goods as well. It's one of the few currencies that it's easy to trade with fiat currencies. Some of the other cryptocurrencies are not so easy to trade with fiat currencies, but it's not clear that Bitcoin will hold the lead forever. We'll see. But like I said, it's not that it's 95%. On the market.
We have covered Bitcoin before on Vox Talks, and there's been a lot about it on Vox EU as well. And certainly the economists I've spoken to over the years, they have tended to dismiss it as any kind of viable alternative to the money we have now or to existing payment systems like Visa or MasterCard, or even as a very distant second best to a central bank digital money. Neil, you sound a little bit more positive about the future for cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Is it time for these economists to revise their view?
I don't think so. It's hard for me to imagine that people will be using Bitcoins as a currency. I mean, it might happen. I think it'll continue to be used as an investment vehicle, perhaps a hedge against inflation. Until recently, there was very little correlation with Bitcoin movement and the movement in, say, like the S&P 500 stock. Mm. That could be a nice addition to one's portfolio. With the prices moving up and down so significantly, it's hard to imagine that it will be a viable alternative to money in the near future. But on the other hand, we see that perhaps because of the success of Bitcoin, central banks have talked about issuing digital currency. Facebook actually was planning to issue a digital currency. So we might see other digital currencies coming into play. These might be backed by central banks, or they could be backed by a firm like Facebook, which I think has more than 2 billion users. I mean, think about the possibility of being able to send the Libra, I think was going to be the coin Facebook was planning to introduce, to sending that via WhatsApp when you want to make a transfer rather than going through Western Union. And I think Western Union charges quite a bit. And you can just imagine that the 2 billion users, the fees could come down quite a bit. So perhaps in that area, we might see digital currencies, but I doubt it'll be Bitcoin.
A final shout out to the economists that are doing all this work, you included as well. I was surprised when I was reading the paper just how much research there is into this, considering it's a fairly recent phenomenon, and it must be quite hard to research. You're forced to be very creative. In doing this roundup of the papers that are available and the types of research there is, it does show that cryptocurrency microeconomics is an interesting and it's a growing part of economics.
It is indeed. And when we wrote the survey, the first draft of it, I think, was more, let's just cover every single paper.
Right, yes.
Give every single paper a paragraph. I think, indeed, one of the referees said that. But in the revision, we thought very hard and very carefully, and we wanted to make this a helpful tool for researchers thinking about getting into the space. So we started on the supply side. We actually introduced the Buddhist formal model, and you can get a lot of mileage out of that. And then we just said, okay, well, that's the supply side. Let's move to the demand side. Okay. And then, of course, price, you know, equilibrium price, supply and demand. And finally, looking at other cryptocurrencies and competition. So that was the way we set up the survey. I mean, I know we didn't cite every single paper out there, but our goal wasn't to do that. It was to say, look, this is what's been done. And there are these other possibilities as well. For example, Bitcoin works on what's called proof of work, which is this mining process. And there are other alternatives like proof of stake, which wastes a lot less electricity, And we actually put a little bit of that in the paper as well. So people who are interested in those mechanisms can think about that. And like you said, going into competition between the cryptocurrencies, which I think is very interesting, we're starting to see a little bit of work as well. And we wanted to cover what had been done in those areas. So
yes, it is important to emphasize that there are whole areas of this that you have covered, but we haven't covered today. And a lot of them are extremely creative areas for research. So I look forward to what you come up with next, Neil. Thank you very much.
Okay, Tim, thanks for having me.
For any of you who want to read the paper, it is CEPR Discussion Paper 14972, The Microeconomics of Cryptocurrencies. And as Neil mentioned, the authors are Hannah Halliburda, Guillaume Heringer, Joshua Gantz, and Neil Gandalf. And as he also mentioned, it is forthcoming in the Journal of Economic Literature. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you never miss an episode. And remember, there are 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.